Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States on relation of Baltazar against Warden. Ms. Potter.
Thank you, Your Honors, Judge Keeney, Judge Estabrook, Judge Wood. I'm pleased to appear before you today on behalf of Dr. Baltazar, who is a relator, a whistleblower under the False Claims Act. In this case, the question before the court is whether or not the public disclosure bar of the False Claims Act applies and whether Dr. Baltazar was an original source. We have quite a bright history in this court, actually, and I think the question before us is, were the allegations in the complaint based upon a public disclosure? According to the defendants, whenever you have a generic industry-wide report of fraud, then it must be so that the claim would be barred. I want to talk a little bit about why that's statutorily incorrect and as a matter of legislative law, and bring to the court's attention, I'd like to start out with some reality of how these cases develop and percolate up through the court system. As of yesterday, it's judicial notice. Everyone knows Smith Glaxo has settled a case for $750 million for adulterated drugs with the United States government. According to the defendant's argument, therefore, because it is known in the industry that pharmaceutical companies adulterate drugs, that would bar anyone, such as Kelly Baltazar, from bringing any case against a pharmaceutical company for adulterated drugs or against Smith GlaxoSmithKline. And in fact, it's about the third settlement for SmithKline this year.
So let me just try to encapsulate what I think the district court might have been concerned about and see what your response is. There, of course, had been all sorts of reports. In fact, this court has seen similar cases of the kinds of fraud that occur in billing practices for Medicare and insurance payments, upcoding, unnecessary procedures, and so forth. And I think there's a concern that somebody could look at those kinds of things, draft a complaint that says, I say it's happening here, and under the standards of Rule 8 and Twombly and Iqbal and so on and so forth, even putting to one side 9b, the concern is some kind of fill-in-the-blank complaint that has to go forward and impose all of the burdens of litigation on someone. And so what does one do about that? I realize Ms. Baltazar says, I knew that this was really happening in this case by this entity. But what do you do with that?
Great question, and I welcome it, and thank you for it. You know, the statute says, as a matter of law, is the complaint based on a publicly disclosed matter investigation in the public domain. And if you look at our complaint, docket number 17, that is not based on a GAO report that 50,000 chiropractors might hypothetically be upcoded.
So but what you're saying basically is one looks at the public reports, and unless the name Advanced Healthcare Associates and Dr. Warden appears in it, then there is no public disclosure.
I would say that's a minimal, and I think this court has followed that rule in Fowler because
the public report, suppose a governmental report, a careful audit by several federal governmental agencies comes to the conclusion that 99.2% of all chiropractors engage in upcoding. Do you think that would be sufficient to be a public disclosure?
I absolutely think it is not, and the teaching of the court to the Tenth Circuit in Cooper is right on point.
Well, why is it? I mean, I would have thought you'd say, sure, 99%, but we don't get that high within
these reports. We don't get that high in these reports.
And because one's concern, I suppose, is if the report, instead of saying 99%, said 50%, then we don't know which 50% are engaging in this practice and which 50% are having perfectly honest, you know, good chiropractic practices.
But that is my point, Your Honors, and the point of the statute in Senator Grassley in the 1986 amendments.
9.2% is enough to convict somebody beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case. You would think it would be quite sufficient to disclose, on average, that this is a problem.
Ah, but Your Honor.
The real difficulty would come in Judge Wood's hypothetical, a report that says 50% of chiropractors are doing something. Now, where do these published reports stand? Are they more like 50%? Are they more like 20%? Or are they more like 99%?
I don't think, Your Honors, it matters, the statistical imperatives.
Could you answer my question? And then you can tell me why you don't think the answer matters.
I think in this case, the GAO...
I didn't ask about this case. I asked about these published reports. What are they closer to, 20%, 50%?
I don't know. I can tell you...
Is that because you haven't read them? That's
no.
Very strange.
It's because I don't know the statistical answer. But
I
do know...
In the record, maybe I'm completely wrong, that there was a range in the reports, that one
yes.
of them was up at the 67% level, another was all the way down at the 16% level.
Correct. But I think that...
Well, why isn't that
so
the
why
answer
Why don't you
judge?
Answer my question using the information in the reports?
I don't think that matters to the fundamental question.
I know you don't think it matters, but I would like you to answer my question.
I don't know the statistical answer. But I will say that the purpose of even talking about generic fraud in an industry is consistent with the congressional purpose of having relators come forward and file specific complaints. We could not have filed a complaint based upon any of these reports, on the GAO report, it'd be Rule 11 and 1927. The specific information comes from Dr. Baltazar's complaint, the billing records that's attached to the complaint, that the public disclosures here in GAO reports and otherwise are generic, do not mention this defendant, do not
Would you
alert.
Be more specific on how her billing records show that this was occurring.
Sure, Your Honor. And it's as occurred in Caremark. She had specific personal knowledge that her billing records were altered and then submitted to private and governmental carriers showing different entries, upcoding, crossing out her entries, putting in entries for patients she never visited or saw. No public report, even 100% reporting, could get the information to the government other than through a specific whistleblower like Kelly Baltazar. It wouldn't matter if the GAO report covered statistically 100% of chiropractors in this country. It wouldn't say that the defendant in this case had altered Dr. Baltazar's bills and that was her common practice. And that's why we have a statute that says public disclosure means you either, as in Fowler, as this court ruled, have to have... Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. This court held in United States XRL Feingold that the public disclosure bar applies only when the critical elements exposing the transaction as fraudulent are placed in the public domain. As this court explained...
How about the question whether a report saying 99% of all chiropractors engage in upcoding is enough to put the critical fact in the public domain?
I think that might well put the critical fact in the public domain. And of course, if a relator can establish that they are an original source, then the case would proceed anyway. And this is not, as the court indicated earlier.
How would you characterize these reports? Or are they closer to 20%, 50%,
well,
two-thirds?
Sure. I mean, well, I think the most favorable report from defendant's perspective in this regard is the 2005 GAO report, which cites the statistic that Judge Woods mentioned earlier as the high end, 67%. That's based upon a sample of 400 claims out of 21 million in a given year that are made by chiropractors, and that's for a single year, 2001. And the report specifically states, and this is document 25.5 at 15 to 17, the document specifically states that these data are not to be extrapolated to other years. And in fact, we think that document alone speaks precisely to the question here, namely whether, as this court stated in Gear, the defendant is directly identifiable from the public disclosure. And that's the same standard that's been cited in other cases.
So your position is that even at the 2 out of 3 level, that's not good enough to make a defendant directly identifiable. Is there any average? No, there was another report that was down at the 16% level, wasn't there?
off the top of my head, I don't recall, although none of the other reports dealt with chiropractor fraud. They dealt with general Medicare fraud.
Yeah, and,
of course, that universe is even less helpful for the purposes of a public disclosure than the chiropractor-specific report in 2005. Again, this is not a standard that this Court alone has adopted. The cases that are cited in GEER, from the Ninth Circuit.
Let's come back to the GAO report. The GAO report found, if I recall correctly, that two-thirds of the claims were excessive. Did it conclude that two-thirds of the claims were fraudulent?
No, it just stated there was error of one kind or another in the claim. And
that, so one presumes that error is a subset, rather a superset of fraud.
That is correct, Your Honor.
I mean, what I'm looking at, actually, is the OIG study. Well, on page 9 of the appellant's brief, there's a CMS comprehensive program that identified a paid claims error rate of approximately 16% for claims submitted by chiropractors in 2002. Again, that's error. That's not necessarily fraud.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, this is a common sense inquiry. In a small industry, it might well be that even a rate of 50 or 60% was enough to allow the government to investigate all of the individuals that would possibly be defrauding the government. But the fact is, with a 50,000-member chiropractic industry that's submitting over 20 million claims a year to Medicare, there is simply no way that a disclosure of this kind puts the government on the trail of fraud in the way that the public disclosure bar is intended to do, and that's the purpose, the balance that the public disclosure bar makes, where a relator is bringing something to the table.
Sure that there's no way. Suppose the government took the GAO report, which said that two-thirds of all claims are excessive, and then serves a demand on every chiropractor in America for a refund based on that report. And it says, look, we've engaged in statistical sampling. That's a perfectly valid means. We want the money back unless you can show that you're in the one-third rather than the two-thirds. Isn't that a perfectly valid demand by the government?
Well, I think what we have to sort of work with is that there are limited resources the United States can employ. And in a situation where Congress recognized there's essentially an inability to identify particular fraudulent actors, could that approach be taken? Yes. Does the government want to take that approach in an industry of this size?
That's roughly the Secretary of Labor's approach in Fair Labor Standards Act cases. They'll do some statistical sampling. And if it looks like people aren't getting proper compensation for overtime, it will extrapolate the results and demand payments based on the sample.
I can't speak to that one way or the other, but I would certainly say that while it's an agency's prerogative to do that, that's not something the False Claims Act requires. And, in fact, the False Claims Act is striking precisely the opposite balance, which is
the False Claims Act requires fraud, and trying to collect for overpayments doesn't require fraud. So it may be that there's this important gap.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, there's a different situation that's presented in a case where an individual is knowingly presenting false claims to the government for payment. And that's precisely the situation that the False Claims Act is meant to address. And where in a situation where the government can't adequately investigate an entire industry, that is the role that the relators are supposed to play under the False Claims Act.
So what's your response to my first question? Because I think one of the concerns on the other side is what I'm thinking of as a fill-in-the-blank complaint that somebody can just say, aha, here are these studies. Looks like a lot of chiropractors bill too much. I'm just going to be a gadfly and file this complaint.
Well, I think the answer was suggested in your question, and it was the question that the 11th Circuit dealt with in Cooper, which is 9B requires that a fraud be pled with particularity. And in the instance that you're describing, 9B presumably wouldn't be satisfied. And the district court actually sort of made some noises on that front as well, but ultimately didn't rest its ruling on 9B. It rested its ruling on the public disclosure bar, and we think that was
error. So in your brief, you actually, toward the end of your brief, indicate that if this case were to go forward on the jurisdictional level, it's not too late for 9B motions or 12B6 motions or other kinds of tests.
I don't know if we'd meant to suggest what the timeliness of that, but certainly with respect to whether the district court ought to have ruled on the 9B motion. I mean, he didn't. He dismissed it as moot. And so presumably that motion could be renewed when it goes back to the district court. That's right.
Right. I'm just looking at the very end of your brief, page 2122, where you say, but that deficiency, if accurate, would offer grounds for the district court to dismiss the PTAM complaint under the
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I would dispute that that notion could be renewed on remand. I mean, I don't know what Relator would have to say
about that. The
United
States takes no position,
correct,
I assume, on that, yeah.
Well, I see my time is just about up, unless there are further questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Counsel.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, the purpose of qui tam lawsuits, as you know, is to alert the government of frauds that it would not otherwise be made aware of. In other words, to let them know that fraud is afoot. That purpose, as this Court has stated in Feingold, is served when the government issues its own report. In this case, as Your Honors have pointed out, the government has indeed done that. From a more general standpoint,
Let's suppose the Securities and Exchange Commission does a careful audit of all the securities registration statements filed in 2010, and it finds that in 50% of the registration statements there is one or more erroneous statement. And it issues a report. It says registration statements full of, you know, false claims. What happens? Does that – I don't want to ask about the False Claims Act. I want to ask whether that starts the statute of limitations for every possible securities fraud claim against every possible issuer in the country.
Your Honor, I think in that instance it would not, unless there was –
What's the difference, then, between starting the statute of limitations for everyone on the ground that there's been a public disclosure of fraud, which is enough to start the statute of limitations, and foreclosing a claim under the False Claims Act?
Your Honor, I gotta have a moment. With regard to public disclosures, if the percentages are minimal in the sense that
two-thirds.
Okay.
The SEC says two-thirds of all registration statements contain one or more false, demonstrably false claims. Right? And I want to know whether that starts the statute of limitations for security suits against every possible securities issuer, given the rule that public disclosure of fraud starts the period of limitations, right? We've got public disclosure rules for periods of limitations. We've got public disclosure rules for the False Claims Act. We got public disclosure rules for quite a few more things, too. Seems to me that if you answer that two-thirds in the GAO report is public disclosure that blocks a False Claims Act suit, you have to say that in my hypothetical, the statute of limitations is running against every securities purchaser in the country, even though that purchaser has no particular reason to believe that any given issuer committed securities fraud.
Your Honor, given the numbers, as you presented that, I think I would agree if it weren't for the original source exception factored into the False Claims Act.
Well, so there's no original source exception for the securities laws, but the question I'm asking is, a government report saying there's a lot of X in industry Y, a public disclosure that a particular person engaged in X?
As to whether, I mean, I think the inquiry there would be who the claimant is, and if it's the United States government, or as here we have a relator stepping into the shoes of the government.
In my hypothetical, the SEC's report is front page news in the Wall Street Journal, which is probably more than the GAO's report was.
Well, I have another way of asking the same question. In Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical, if you purchased the shares of Company B, and so you said, aha, there's been fraud shown in two-thirds of the companies, and you then filed a lawsuit against Company B under Rule 10b-5 saying that there had been fraud in the purchase and sale of your security, would your lawsuit be subject to dismissal on Rule 11 grounds? All you know is that two out of three companies, according to our front page Wall Street Journal article, have something fraudulent.
It would seem in that instance it would not, Your Honor, be barred by a statute of limitations with the statute.
No, I'm not asking that. I'm saying that was Judge Easterbrook's question. My question is, you now file a lawsuit against Company B because you bought Company B's stock, and you see that two out of every three companies have fraud problems. Is your lawsuit subject to dismissal on Rule 11 grounds? You don't know anything about Company B other than what Judge Easterbrook is talking about.
it would seem without any more diligent inquiry, it very well may be, because you may fall in the one-third and have no reasonable basis for filing the suit.
Exactly.
And in this instance...
So why wouldn't that be true here? Why, if a third of the chiropractors in the country are absolutely scrupulous with their billings, why isn't that enough to say that, knowing that two-thirds may have some problems, fraudulent or otherwise, why doesn't that make this suit perfectly reasonable?
Well, I think it goes back to, I hope I'm addressing Your Honor's question, in that the one of the overarching inquiries is whether the government is on the trail of the fraud, and I think Mr. Fleisig-Green pointed that out. And from at least 2005, the government had sharpened its pencil and put a specific focus on the chiropractic industry, and had laid out and made an inquiry into how many billing irregularities, unnecessary procedures, and the amount of money that had been paid by Medicare to these physicians, so that they were able to investigate specific instances of potential fraud.
But the government pays a lot of claims over the course of a year, even just to chiropractors, not to mention the entire medical industry, I'll call it. And I'm sure the government doesn't on purpose pay out money for fraudulently submitted claims. So how big a staff do you think CMS has?
Well, I think what CMS has done specific to the chiropractic industry is put extremely tight reins on the chiropractic industry. As mentioned in that OIG report, there are only certain billing codes that Medicare will even pay for chiropractic services.
Yeah.
And they go to
I'm sure there are only certain billing codes they pay for urology, too, you know.
Well,
what's the difference?
I think the point is that because there are specific restrictions placed on chiropractic services, including the volume of how many visits or appointments somebody can have, that the CMS system or Medicare is able to identify irregularities in billing by specific providers.
But how – I don't see how that gets you down to the granular level of Dr. Warden and Advanced Healthcare Associates. How do we know – I assume they're going to defend what they do anyway, but, you know, how do we know that they allegedly have engaged in impermissible billing practices?
Well,
based on these public reports.
Well, based on the published reports, one couldn't read that and state with express certainty Dr. Lillian Warden or Advanced Healthcare Associates.
Right,
no
and
doubt
so
about
to take
that.
The language in our Gear case, this is not then one of those industry-wide public disclosures that makes someone directly identifiable from the public disclosures. That was the phrase we used, directly identifiable.
Certainly. And in Gear, they were dealing with, at least on the face of that opinion, that there was a smaller
pool. Sure, yeah, it was 125 schools. So in other words, you're not Gear. You've just agreed that you don't fall in the Gear rule.
From a quantifiable standpoint, you're right, Your Honor. I think where we don't have guidance is in the statute itself. And the statute itself doesn't place a specific percentage or number of what percentage of the industry has to be implicated in this. And that's where we fall into the gray matter. I think what I actually looked for, and we pointed it out on footnote 3 of our brief, I believe it was on page 17, was that there have been amendments since Judge Norgal and the district court decided this case, and Congress didn't address any quantifiable or numerosity or whether a specific defendant had to be expressly identified in that statute. And while it's certainly not the statute this court is being asked to interpret and apply, it speaks to whether – I think that's where we do go back to Gear. And we say that where there's an industry-wide implication, such as here, we're not talking about general Medicare. We're talking about the chiropractic industry, where specific violations or potential violations have been written since 2005. And in this state alone –
I don't understand what use you're trying to make of this later inapplicable – legislation.
I guess in terms of applying the statute and trying to figure out at what number we would cut off or at what number provides a claimant or a court with the ability to set a threshold.
Why isn't it just what we said in Gear? Do the public disclosures allow the government directly to identify the people who are the wrongdoers.
Well, and if we were to apply that here, while the industry in Illinois is larger than GEER, admittedly on its facts it's different, but because the OIG report and subsequent reports in the news media have focused specifically on chiropractors, we are able to focus in, or the public is able to focus in, on the chiropractic industry specifically. And from there, knowing what types of potential abuses can be had, such as upcoding or providing unnecessary treatment, one is able to take that information, put in a chiropractor's name, and file a complaint. And that's, you know, with the purpose of QI-TAM, that's obviously not the purpose of QI-TAM legislation or litigation.
Mr. Fleissig Green suggests that that complaint would be bounced immediately on Rule 9b grounds if there was nothing more specific.
Well, and Appley would agree.
Did you make a motion under 9b, or did you just attack at the threshold?
We did file a separate motion under 9b, and that's where the district court...
That was dismissed as moot. Yeah.
Right. I mean, certainly that would be the intent, depending on what happens in this court. But and for the same reasons of a lack of specificity in setting forth. And I think that goes to the original source issue, jumping way ahead to step three, that the original source contemplates somebody such as Dr. Baltazar being able to provide, with direct and independent knowledge, the critical elements of the fraud claim.
Why isn't it direct? I mean, this is maybe a bit of a field, unless we were to reach original source. But if she says, you know, you say that I saw four patients on, September 15th, and I only saw two patients on September 15th, and I remember this out of my personal experience, and I so swear in an affidavit, why isn't a combination of the record plus her affidavit quite specific?
Well, with regard to the direct knowledge, within the allegations of the complaint, the direct knowledge of the actual instances of fraud or submission of these fraudulent or misrepresented statements to the government came from third parties.
Well, but she's the one who's saying what was submitted to the payor. I don't understand why she's not an original source in the kind of situation I've described, where she says, I know, here's the day, here's the coding, here's the report, and I know it was fraudulent. What more notice could someone possibly have? Now you know what to defend against. You can say, well, actually, something else.
Well, in many of the cases, specifically, I think it was Feingold, I believe. It was actually, and I may be mistaken on that, but within the FCA case law, the examples are people who are actually in the billing, the seat of the biller. And they actually know what was submitted and in what form to Medicare for reimbursement. In this case, there's an intervening agency or person that fills that gap between Dr. Baltazar and any false claim. And that's where she would not qualify as an original source, because under...
Well, you're talking about the original source of who submits the bill. She's the original source, or allegedly she's claiming she's the original source on the evidence of fraud. And she says, I know what was submitted, and I know what I turned in, and there's a discrepancy, and it's a fraudulent one.
Well, I mean, surely if this were a situation where Dr. Baltazar knew what was on the form, knew what services were provided in the whole context of a given patient's care and treatment, and then went the next step and knew what was subsequently billed.
Isn't that what counsel indicated, though?
Yeah.
I asked her about specifics.
Yeah.
I think what we have, Your Honor, is, and the reason for our 9B motion to begin with, was the fact that there was that gap between what Dr. Baltazar said was provided to a patient, what was put on the ultimate care and treatment plan, and then the gap between that and what was submitted to Medicare for reimbursement. And that's the gap that we say does not allow her to plead with specificity in compliance with Rule 9b.
Tell me again where the gap is. Maybe I missed it.
Well, under the false claim, you have to show that a claim was actually submitted to Medicare. And what we have right now, based on the complaint as it sat or sits, is stopping short of what was submitted to Medicare. It was only saying, in my personal opinion, that care and treatment wasn't provided. It doesn't, by me. It doesn't go to the next step and say, was it provided by anyone else? And then it doesn't go the final step of saying that it was ultimately submitted in that form. Here's the invoice, like there was in Caremark. of saying here's the specific situation where this claim was submitted.
Well, what you're saying is actually quite contradictory to what appears in the briefs, so I suppose we can read the complaint. But I gather, according to what the complaint alleges, each provider fills out her or his own billing slip. Dr. Baltazar wasn't filling out billing slips talking about what other people in the practice did.
Right, but subsequently, at least at Advanced Healthcare, there are billing clerks who then go through the billing records and then prepare what's going to be submitted to Medicare. Your Honor, I see my time has expired. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Next case is Jacob Osborne.